for putting it together, and for Dr. Kleinman for helping him.
For channeling it.
Channeling it and getting it out to all of us today. But good overview of where we've been and what we've done and some of the things that need to happen from this point on. It's interesting you mentioned community health workers, Dushyanka. There is a movement that is beginning in this country in community health workers. APHA has a SPIG of community health workers, and two of the organizers came up to me at this meeting and said, Myron, we need 40 more people to join as a second section, a primary section, and then we can become a section of APHA. And once you become a section of APHA, then you get funding and much more visibility. So all of you who are here, feel free to join the community health workers section as a second section. Of course, oral health is your first section, but join it as a second or third, and let's get them to become a section in APHA. A lot I could say about Dushyanka's presentation, but I just want to mention one cute little funny thing that happened many years ago. When I was president of APHA, I wrote a column entitled The Neglected Epidemic in the United States. Many years later, and Bob called me once on it, and they used it in California, which was very nice. But when Dushyanka was working on the Surgeon General's report, she called me, she said, Myron, we're going to use your term in the Surgeon General's report. I said, oh, I said, what term is that? She said, we're going to call it the silent epidemic. I said, Dushyanka, it's the neglected epidemic. She said, oh, too late, it's in print. So we have a silent epidemic instead of a neglected epidemic, but we're still getting a lot of visibility and accountability. And again, thank you, Dushyanka. As I mentioned when we started, the title of today's presentation is How Can We Make Oral Health a Much Higher Priority in Our Country? And now we're going to get the local perspective. And the best person I could think of for the local perspective was Dr. Jonathan Fielding. Jonathan is director of the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health and a county health officer. He has all of the public health responsibilities that we're familiar with for some 10 million residents of LA County. He has a budget of about $750 million and a staff of about 4,000 individuals. He's also on the Los Angeles First Five Commission, which grants over $100 million per year to improve the health and development of children 0 to 5. Dr. Fielding has done many other things, and I want to mention a few of them because many of you in oral health may not be familiar with the things he's been involved in nationally, so I think it's worth taking the time. He chairs the U.S. Community Preventive Services Task Force. As you know, that task force came out strongly in support of community water fluoridation and the role of sealants in school prevention programs. He was a founding member of the U.S. Clinical Preventive Services Task Force, which delineated what works in prevention that all physicians should utilize. And in the first edition, oral health was included in terms of oral cancer screening, but in the later editions, it wasn't. It was modified a bit. And maybe this is a chance to, you know, give a little push there. More importantly, more recently, he now chairs the Secretary, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary's Advisory Committee on a National Health Promotion and Disease Prevention Objectives for 2020. In other words, Healthy People 2020, he chairs that steering committee, a very important position. And before we knew he was going to be chairing it, we heard that a steering committee was going to be formed, and the White House had final say as to who was going to be on that advisory committee. And we in public health were very upset that there would not be anyone on there who knew anything meaningful in terms of what needs to be done in this country, because it would be politicized. And then when we found that Jonathan was the chair and Sharika was the vice chair, we felt much better about it, and we knew they do the right thing for the right reasons. So he passed a White House test. I don't know how he did it, but he did it, and we're very pleased that he made that screen. He's a professor in the schools of medicine and public health at UCLA. He's authored over 175 different publications and chapters and books. He is an editor of the Annual Review of Public Health and chairman of Partnership for Prevention. He's a member of the Institute of Medicine. He got his medical degree from Harvard. He got his MPH from Harvard. And he got his MBA from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a vice president at Johnson & Johnson. He's received numerous awards. I first met him in, I think it was December of 1973, his last day being medical director for the Job Corps. He was interviewing me. I had been recommended to be the regional dental consultant for New England for Job Corps. And as he's packing, he was interviewing me. I don't know if you remember that, Jonathan. And I said, gee, this kid's going to go places someday. And sure enough, he did. He was also the commissioner for the Massachusetts Department of Public Health from 1975 to 1979. And we did a lot of work with him and Jim Hyde and a lot of people in the state health department. He's a fantastic multitasker. He does many, many things at the same time. Very committed to public health and also very committed to oral health. And I'm very pleased to introduce to you today Dr. Jonathan Field.
I wonder if whoever's in charge of the lights can turn on the bank of lights and the size. I don't know why the light should only shine on the people in the middle and the others have to. Let's see if that. Yeah, I don't. That's not a political statement. I was thinking actually the floods that are here. No. There they go. Okay. I thought that might be. I think you're going to be able to see this. And the reason that I was asked to do this, I have no idea, because I don't know. Anything that could be compared to the knowledge of Dr. Kleinman. I am not an expert in oral health and dental care, but what I wanted to do was to talk about why local health departments should be more involved and concerned about dental health. I can assure you that that the issue is one that is reflected in the difficulties that APHA has as an organization. And APHA is a wonderful organization, but doesn't do terribly well in advocating and lobbying for areas because the people interested in dental health are not as interested in reproductive health. And the people concerned about bioterrorism are not as interested in chronic disease control. And so trying to make us a family is a very, very difficult task. Now, speaking of that, let me ask, how many of you in the room are not dental health professionals? Okay, so we have maybe a third or so, which is great. But I think one of the real issues that we have is the issue of marketing. And we have to think, how do we market the importance of oral health to people for whom that is not the first impulse to say, oh yes, that's terribly important, that's as important as the area that I was trained in. And I will talk a little bit about that. I think one of the opportunities is to talk about dental issues and oral health issues as prevention. Beyond fluoride. Fluoride, of course, as you know, has been something that has not been an area of agreement among people of different ideologic perspectives. And at first, when I first started in public health, the major concerns about fluoridation were coming from the John Birch Society and other organizations that were considered quite right-wing. Now, a lot of the opposition that, and I get stuff daily, comes from the folks oftentimes on the far left. It sounds like it's a beautiful circle, and I guess the far left and the far right do come together. Let me give you, however, my perspective, and it will be much less informed in terms of the research. But I hope it provides ways that we can build the bridges that are absolutely essential. Yeah, I'm disappointed that I have no relationships. Okay, so why should oral health be a priority? Well, this is roughly how much we spent on dental services. This is probably a little old, but we have 500 million visits to dental offices a year. This was the, this is old, this is probably closer to 700 or 800 million now, but at least in this number, the inpatient hospital charges for diseases of the mouth and disorders of the teeth and jaws was about $500 million. Used to be that that was real money. I think what's really important for a lot of folks in medicine, as well as in other aspects of public health, are the relationship that Dr. Kleinman talked about in more detail, but the associations between oral infections, thinking about this as an infectious disease, and diseases which are not always considered. Sure, you have the bacteremias and the like, but when you think about heart disease and you think about diabetes, that is not a natural act to relate those two for people who have not been thinking about this. And stroke. And preterm low birth weight babies. I think that's where we need to start helping people to understand that if you're, for example, an obstetrician gynecologist and you're concerned about good outcomes for the moms, you have to be concerned about oral health. And I want to come back to this. So my suggestion, which is wholly unoriginal, is that we think about who we can partner with in dental health by thinking about the different stages of life. And I have arbitrarily divided it into these four stages. So if you look, this is in California, if you look at early childhood, you look at caries in California, our children fall well below the nation in oral health. 54% of kindergartners in the most recent survey have had at least one cavity. And 75% of children by the third grade have experienced tooth decay. That's 3 in 4. Of course, it's the most prevalent problem that we have. But if you ask the general public what's the most common problem in children, I bet you that not 1 in 10 would say dental caries. So that's our problem. We haven't made the sale. We haven't been assertive enough. We haven't been convincing enough that this is something that the public should be concerned about. Because even if people are not concerned about themselves as much, they're very concerned about their kids. And that's why I think I divided these stages, because you can get people to be much more engaged when you talk about their kids and the fact that if they have problems early in life with tooth, teeth, they're likely to have problems throughout the life course. That's, you're consigning them to problems that parents don't want to consign their kids to. So part of that may be health literacy, but the other part is marketing, it's making the sale. So, and then when you talk about the results of neglected oral health, you have nutrition problems. I want to come back to that. Sleep deprivation, attention deficit, missed school days, slower social development. These are all things that not only parents are concerned about, but policymakers are concerned about. Spending a lot of money on preschool education. Look how much is spent on Head Start, for example. But how much is spent thinking about these issues? And then we have the preventive measures, early screening. Most kids, at least in Los Angeles County, aren't screened as early as they should be. Parents don't necessarily know. I was glad that there were 500 to 700 pediatricians. I'm a pediatrician. I'm a professor of pediatrics. I'm glad that they were at the AAP listening to Dental Health or Oral Health 101. But when you come to EPHA and you say there are between 11 and 13,000 people here, and how many of them are going to go to a single session that deals with oral health, I would say it'd be a de minimis number. But water fluoridation obviously is number one, but early screening, and then the education to parents. And one of the things that we miss is the close relationship that we need to have between the nutritionists and nutrition education. I mean, it is not just fortuitous that kids today have so many dental caries. It is not that somebody forgot to give them some pill. It is not even those that have water fluoridation, sometimes you see some caries because the amount of substrate that there is for the bacteria. There was an effort in California, AB Assembly Bill 1433 passed in 2007 requiring dental screening as part of kindergarten enrollment. Even if you spell enrollment properly. And the pros of that were that parents established, the hope was that parents would establish a dental home in an early stage of their child's life, so it will become second nature. But unfortunately, it's real easy to opt out of this requirement. And schools who don't really want to enforce it just say, sign the waiver right here. So unfortunately, the schools are not enforcing it. There's a really easy way out. And I don't think, again, there is the degree of public support that's necessary. Well, now let's look at the school age. Certainly water fluoridation always has to be number one, but the sealants program has to be number two in areas where there is not adequate fluoridation. And it's a complicated situation, at least in California and Southern California, because we have combinations of a wholesaler that wholesales water to roughly 18 million California residents, and you have local sources of water and other sources of water that don't come through this wholesaler. So you have a whole bunch of places that have mixed now situations, but not necessarily the minimum level of fluoride that we think is essential, and I'll come back to that as well. So we need to educate the pediatricians as well as the dental health professionals. Building coalitions is critical on the preschool side. We had AB 1433. It was a step in the right direction, unfortunately only a baby step. We have the problem of advocating during the budget cut processes for Dentical, Medi-Cal in California for dental health care services is called Dentical. And then, of course, you have the fluoridation task force. Dr. Pollack has been very important in that. A number of other people in this room, Tim Collins, who is our dental director, has done a superb job in really helping to negotiate the tricky political structure that led us to have much broader fluoridation than we did less than a decade ago. I think in terms of the Oral Health Access Coalition, it is directed towards improving the oral health status of the state's traditionally underserved and vulnerable populations, has 25 organizations, and it's the broadest base and most unified voice for oral health. But once again, it relies largely on the base of the provider community and the academic community. It doesn't have the full weight in terms of active engagement of public health professionals, with some exceptions. Now, the California, the local health officers are supported. And I certainly am very supportive. But if you ask local health officers, where does this fit, you know, in terms of your priorities, it wouldn't always fit near the top. Let's go to adulthood. Again, water fluoridation, but increasing access to care. I was so glad to hear Dr. Kleiman talk about the issue of disparities. I can tell you that in the report that we are, in the next few days, going to provide to Secretary Leavitt, that this issue of disparities, which is really a form of inequities, is going to be highlighted. And we are going to suggest that a substantial effort needs to be undertaken to try and reduce these. Now, in some cases, it's going to require attention to the underlying social, economic, and physical determinants of health, which are the main reasons for systematic differences. But one can't ignore that there are some real differences in access to, use of, and quality of services as well. And that, in many ways, is the easier part to deal with. And if we want to, so one of the things I think we need to highlight, again, from a marketing point of view, is that this is the poster child for disparities. And I don't think most people understand that. And then with adults, again, the access to care being a major issue, and of course then the risk for periodontal disease. The 2008 Medi-Cal budget excluded dental. The governor's budget excluded adult Medi-Cal to cut costs, and we worked on advocating with legislatures not to cut the Medi-Cal dental benefits, but it's not an easy fight. And for those of you who don't know, we're in wonderful shape budgetarily in California. So those of you who are worried about the national recession, you know, if you come to California, we can take your mind off it by thinking about California's problems. We had no spine on the part of our legislature. They couldn't agree. The Republicans and Democrats both being in relatively safe seats. The governor tried to broker something in between. The Republicans wouldn't raise taxes. The Democrats wouldn't give on some key issues. And so we have a budget that is really smoke and mirrors with a very substantial deficit even before the recession. So things are going to be very, very difficult here, even in the absence of what's going on nationally. And that does not augur well for the kind of things we're concerned about, certainly in terms of care. For elder adults, again, water fluoridation, trying to prevent root caries, access to care, which was highlighted in Dr. Kleinman's presentation, remains a major issue. And then oral health education, the relationship between oral health and other diseases. And I can tell you, it is really tragic to see how many people in our county, in our state, and in our nation are trying to make decisions between eating and getting dental care or other medical care, or taking their medication and cutting pills in half because they can't afford it, and not going to see the dentist, and letting their teeth deteriorate, and letting that perhaps have systemic effects as well. And certainly affects their ability to masticate, their ability to digest foods, and can in many ways affect intake overall. So all these are related, and we have to be united, and we have to sell this. We have to sell that these are big problems. Now, for example, I talked about the importance of working with nutritionists. How strong is the alliance with AARP? That's a question that we should ask ourselves. They are the strongest organization advocating for the elderly. They also sell health insurance. So there are issues there. But they are the likely strongest supporter for a coalition. Okay. Now, I've heard that those of us in this room actually would like to age because the alternative is less attractive. And the population, that took a bit, the population 65 and over will double within 25 years. So problems that start now and are not addressed with children and with adults are going to become even greater epidemics that are going to be much louder, not just silent, but loud epidemics where people are going to be screaming about this, not just in pain, but because of neglect, within the next 10 to 25 years. One-third of all Americans will reach age 50 by 2010. You can see how that has gone up significantly. And we have large-scale needs in the older residents. There was an assessment done with the Los Angeles Community and Senior Services, the City of Los Angeles Department of Aging, and the County Commission on Aging, and that was this year. And the results were, among specific areas of health care, this was a broader survey, dental care was most often identified as unaffordable. I don't know if you've noticed, but people talk to me about their dental plans and how they're paying for less and less as a percentage of what the care that they're getting. The plans aren't keeping up, and they are having to make difficult decisions. And for poor people, sometimes there's not much decision. And I'm not talking about the people who have Medi-Cal. I'm talking about people making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year for a family. And you look at what percentage is going to homes. That was before foreclosure. You look at what the food costs, the transportation costs, and you say, you know, these families just don't have enough to go around. This is one of the areas that suffers. In terms of the elderly, 61% had inadequate or lacked dental insurance, inadequate care or lacked dental insurance. Now, that's just a national crime. And once again, I doubt that most people know this. I doubt that our politicians know it and that they are doing anything about it in most cases. So what's our local health officer's role? Well, I was one who, with the wonderful support of Tim Collins, appeared before the Metropolitan Water District, that's the big wholesaler, urging that they fluoridate all the water they supplied. They may be the largest wholesaler in the country, I don't know, but they're certainly one of the biggest. And in fact, all the local health officers representing the counties served by this testified before the board endorsing water fluoridation. And we picked the time when we thought we could get it through. And it was a number of years in the making. And then we thought, you know, maybe we could get it through by one vote in the key committee. And because of a lot of wonderful work on the part of a lot of people, including some in this room, it got through. But it was not exactly a slam dunk. Remember that we serve a lot of areas like Orange County and San Diego where the population is not necessarily wild about the issue of fluoridation. So this led to the fluoridation of all the water plants in December of 2007. I think we also have the opportunity to highlight oral health at the local level in the same manner as the U.S. Surgeon General. We put out all kinds of briefs about the health of the Los Angeles County population. We do a Los Angeles Health Survey every 2 to 2.5 years, and we publish a lot about that. We need to make sure that we have oral health high on that priority list. Now, getting the money to conduct an oral health needs assessment has been elusive, but that's another thing we should have high on our agenda and try and figure out. In terms of legislation, that's one of the areas we need for funding. If people don't know there's a problem, they don't see it as a common present danger imperiling people's health, they are not going to care enough about it. So we need to have more and current oral health needs assessments. And then what we need to do at a minimum is to add pertinent oral health questions to pre-existing surveys and health questionnaires. There are so many things that we are doing today, and they don't always include oral health questions. Now, what I did in year 2000, when the Surgeon General's report was issued, I scheduled a press conference, again, with wonderful support from Tim Collins, to provide remarks about that in terms of how it applied to Los Angeles County. And, you know, I made the same point that the Surgeon General made, that you couldn't have good general health without good oral health. So, here is what I think we also can do, and that is use whatever prestige and stature we have in terms of local health officers to raise this as an issue. If we talk about it enough, some people sometimes, or at least occasionally, listen. And usually when we put out something in LA County, we get press about it, probably because we're the number two media market. So, and there are a lot of local health departments that can do that, and there's a lot of local media that are really anxious to have these kind of stories and have the local applications. So here's some suggestions. Call for a report or study in your area. Launch a major oral health initiative. Sponsor a major collaborative in your jurisdiction that addresses oral health issues. Get all the people together that oftentimes, you know, have informal contacts but may not spend a lot of time together. And then create a high-level oral health division within your department. I only have 2 people in my oral health division out of 4,000, but those 2 people have had greater impact than many other divisions that have large numbers of people providing services, just because of the emphasis on policy. Eliminate barriers. Send the message through the department that oral health is important. Eliminate any barriers between the dental professionals and the rest of your department. And oral health should have a prominent position in the strategic plan, as in fact it does. It needs to be part of the strategic plan. And the same kind of linkages that I was talking about that haven't been made in the external world have to be made internally. For example, we have a Department of Senior Health. That has 1 person right now, or maybe 2. But they, again, focusing on policy, they need to work together. We have a nutrition department. They need to work together on oral health issues. And we need to eliminate the EBD meeting concept, everyone but dental, and replace it with DAT. Dental is always there. And with that, I will leave it open for questions. And I think that there is so much opportunity, but I think that what's missing primarily is that marketing. And we have to market, and we have to hone the messages, and we have to be coordinated, and we have to have local health officers, some of whom may not see this yet as a sufficient priority. We need to get them in a room like this, all of them, to say, okay, how do you measure what's important to you, and showing why oral health fits within that rubric. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I guess what we need to do is find out how we can clone you for the 2,900 other local health departments in the country and most of the state health offices. What I want to do now is just open us up for Q&A. And I just want to make one comment before I do that, Jonathan. You mentioned AARP. And last year we had the president of AARP come and speak to the oral health section, Dr. Olson, who also happens to be a dentist. He talked primarily about the $60 million they were putting into their campaign for a national health program around the election. But we did pressure him a little bit about including oral health in their insurance plan. And he did say, we're looking at it and we're doing a little pilot. So, you know, we are thinking along the lines you are as well. Do either of the panelists have a question of each other before we open it up to
I
the
have
audience?
A question.
Sure.
Well, my question is, why are we one letter away? Now, this year, there was a bill for parity. And what was it for? Mental health. So all were one letter away from parity. And it seems to me that that needs to be a substantial push. What's standing in the way?
Do you want to respond to that? Do you want to respond to that? Sure.
Help. The mental health advocacy structure has been incredible, first of all. When they came out with the first Surgeon General's report on mental health, they developed a strategy to have multiple other reports come out that were targeted along the age groups that you highlighted. So through that process of focusing on children and women and the elderly, they were able to form the coalitions that you had. I think we have a lot of lessons to learn from that infrastructure that was built, but also a lot to learn from alliances, because if you were to look at many of the severe mental illnesses, you know how debilitating oral conditions are due to medications effects and just self-care, loss of self-care. So as an movement in oral health, we have to be much broader. We have similarities in terms of the service delivery. We have mental and dental. We have similarities in terms of reimbursement per service, per hour, per unit, so to speak. I just think they formed a much more strategic approach to empowering the various population groups to make a difference. And we need to hook up with them, but we also need to build along the lines that you had said. I just wanted to, does somebody want to say something about that? MD, is the MD? Is that what you're talking about, the shift? I was going to ask about how we could work with the local health officers and set up a symposium at the next meeting of local health officers to address the questions that you have posed.
Well, the local health officers are represented by NACHO, and there is a new head of NACHO, Bobby Pestrunk, and I would hope that they would be very amenable to that. I would also suggest, however, that you look at this on a state-by-state basis. There usually is a coalition of county or city health officials in every state, and you can't just do this by doing it at national meetings. It has to have a grassroots effect. as well. So you need to do it in your locales, you need to then do it at the state level, and in addition, do it at the national meetings. Actually, there was every two or three times, I forget, or maybe it's more often than every three times. I don't remember how often the state and local health officers meet together. There was a meeting this year, it was in Sacramento, and I think there was a decision to do it going forward. I don't remember if it was every year or every other year, but in any case, that's another opportunity, because in many, as I look at states, there are a lot of states for whom this is really not high on their priority list either, except as a health care issue for Medi-Cal, and that usually drives the policy. And you need, one of the advantages that we've gained over the past few years in California and Los Angeles is separating the Department of Public Health from the Department of Health Services. So we are freer to advocate more broadly, and people start to understand that public health is concerned with everybody's health, not just those, not just people who need government-provided services for categorical groups.
I just want to ask one question of Jonathan, and then we'll open it up to the audience. Sorry, Bob. I want to put you on the spot, Jonathan. You have 10 million people. You have 4,000 employees, and you have two in oral health. And as you know, oral health affects everybody, and especially with vulnerable population groups, the medically compromised, HIV, the homeless, et cetera, et cetera. Why do you have two and not 10, 12, or 15? And given all the problems you have and every local health officer has, given all those competing priorities, how can we get oral health addressed better for disparities in the general population?
Well, it's not just a question of numbers. I mean, I have a lot of public health nurses, for example, but they're doing clinically related work and home visits and the like, so they're really not comparable. And the question is one, I mean, we do address dental health issues. For example, we spend about $88 million a year on services for people with HIV and AIDS, and dental care is part of that, and we do have people working in that area. But I think what many departments lack is a strategic policy focus. And as far as I'm concerned, the kind of people that we need in a number of different areas, I'd rather have one person who's really smart and knows how to work the policy stuff than having a bunch of people, you know, who might be concerned about different populations and might have good information and might have good networking skills but aren't going to be able to help in the advocacy. I think it's time for advocacy and public education. And so I've opted for that. Now, even though I have 4,000 people, that doesn't mean I have flexibility in terms of whom I can hire for what or how much. Most of the lines, as you know, for public health are kind of stovepipe lines. And the money that we get from the county is a relatively small portion. And a lot of that is allocated against maintenance of effort in different programs and substance abuse and children with special health care needs, et cetera, et cetera. So the flexibility I have is a lot different than the total budget. But you're absolutely right that everybody should have, what's important in my view is to have somebody there who can work the politics, who can be a good colleague for coalitions, and also can be part of the senior staff and will have the respect by virtue of their knowledge and their expertise so that they're viewed as a member of the senior staff, which is one way to make sure that dental health services and oral health and prevention receive the priority they deserve.
Thank you. Bob, could you stand up so we can hear you?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Dr. Fielding, but I'd also like to put you on the spot in a little bit different context and ask you to take advantage of the position that you have in California. You know, California, with a brief few-month exception a number of years ago, hasn't had a state dental director in almost 15 years. Besides LA County, there's only one other county health department in California of the 58 counties that has a dental public health trained dental director, you know, the equivalent of Tim Collins. So, you know, you have a bully pulpit through the California Conference of Local Health Officials and your connections with the Department of Public Health as well as the Department of Health Care Services in the state. You could be a tremendous boon in helping to promote what you're promoting to us.
You're absolutely right that the issues, I must admit I am on the advisory committee for the state public health department, and I was one of the biggest advocates for forming it, in testimony to separate it from health services. And my hope is that they will get a dental director, and it's something that I will advocate for. The problem they've had is they're facing very substantial cutbacks. And it's just, it's a difficult time. It doesn't mean that, it doesn't suggest that they shouldn't do it, but it does mean when you're cutting, and nobody's looking, willing to look at new positions or filling vacant positions, is a very difficult time. And I think that's the, unfortunately, that's the situation they've been under. But it doesn't, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's an essential position, and I hope that that the coalition in California is talking to Mark Horton, the head of public health, about that. In terms of the other CCLHO members, you have to divide them up because, you know, some counties have 15 or 20,000 people and they have four employees, and others are, you know, are substantial in size. And you really need to start with those that are substantial in size. But I think we probably should do more, and I probably should do more to, I certainly talked to the members of the large counties about our experience, and we've enlisted the health officers in supporting fluoridation and trying to push for that. And I think you're right that the next step is to try and get them to see if they can see their way clear to hire at least one person who has the, you know, the stature and the perspective. And I would also say that finding people with the stature and perspective is not always easy, but that's no excuse.
House Lapkin can help you.
Yes.
No doubt.
Do you two know each other? Dr.
Yes.
Slavkin? Okay,
yes,
just okay, good. Question in the back, John?
At the opening session yesterday, Michael Marmot eloquently referred to social gradients and disparities and made very clear that these can't be overcome by the singular focus that we've had in recent times on individual health services. The major aspects of those disparities and gradients must be corrected, even if we do manage to improve access. And Dr. Fielding, you referred to some of that in your talk. He also said, of course, that we should stop talking about doing these things because it'll make people employable, and say straight out that we're going to do them because of social justice and return to those old values. Now, my question is, in considering this large range of factors, housing, income, employability, social integration, and, by the way, community-based services, where are we going to put our focus other than in individual treatment programs to try to overcome these disparities in social gradients in our own?
I'm happy to answer that. Yeah, I've for many years been trying to push the issue that we cannot effectively reduce, much less eliminate, many of the disparities without attention to the issue of inequities, without looking at the social gradient, without intersectoral collaboration on issues that range from tax policy, agriculture, transportation, etc. And in our strategic plan, that is a focus. Within my department, I have two task forces, one working on the physical environment, working on land use planning, on urban development, on transportation, on infill housing, on all those things, working closely with other agencies, and a task force on social determinants, which includes economic. And we are active in the policy arena, trying to build coalitions and trying to lend our voice on many of these issues. We don't have enough capacity to deal with all of them, but we're trying to prioritize, at least with respect to Los Angeles County and California. So I've said that is ultimately the only way that we can reduce the disparities and inequities. So we don't disagree at all with that. Now, having said that, on the other hand, there is clearly a preventable burden that we shouldn't just forget about, because we know that that does not apply to all areas. So I would still argue that fluoridation is absolutely essential, and that it's one of the few things we know that is cost beneficial. You can get business support for, you can get employers, for the most part. So I would not want to have to decide between which of those two, the underlying determinants or fluoridation, I had to focus on. I think they're equally important. On the issue of allocation of dollars, however, we have allocated a disproportionate amount towards healthcare in all its forms. And we are spending over 16% of our GDP on health care services, which is really more medical care, but health care services compared to 10-11% at the most for our trading partners. So I also don't want to forget about the economic effects. You've talked about productivity. It is a matter of social justice, but the way to get support from a broad coalition is not just to talk about social justice. You have to talk about productivity, you have to talk about economic development, you have to talk about competitiveness. Because if you look at today what people are concerned about, unlike 9 months ago where Iraq was number one, it's the economy. And if we don't get the kind of partnerships we need around those kind of issues, we're not going to, if we can yell social justice as loud as we can, we're not going to have sufficient mobilization of all the partners to, in fact, enact the kind of changes we need. So when we talk about the other benefits, we can get a much wider coalition and focus on the same issues.
Victor Fuchs just had an editorial in the recent New England Journal of Medicine focused on what he called inconvenient truths related to healthcare reform, and sort of looked at that more services and access side, and he highlighted the issue of the rising costs, which will be never ending, the emergence always of the gifts of research, which are new technologies, and the fact that we will always have a component of our population that requires safety net and subsidies. And he spoke to each of these three areas that require some control, but he also put forth some considerations, such as creating a similar to what England has in terms of an institute that looks at the evidence-based practices and makes a determination about emerging technologies before introducing them into the system, and also taking a look at costs and benefits related to them, and then withdrawing something. So I think we have to look on both sides. I think one side of looking at issues of social justice, we're moving forward in a wonderful way of maybe we're too eager to move as quickly as we would like to make sure that the alma ata type of philosophy is welcomed, and that we move into the whole area of the social determinants. But we at the same time have to look at the machinery that is within the system at large. And there was also in that same issue a wonderful article with a model that was put in place by the Commonwealth Fund with proposed interventions that, if put in place in the area of health promotion, disease prevention, what the out-year cost reductions would be. I think what we, I was talking to Alice the other day, as we were talking about this particular session, you almost have to, and this is a dental term, acid etch a particular part of our society in order to start anew. And one of my favorite architects, Rem Koolhaas, designs green space within cities, expands that capacity and takes a whole city and decides what to demolish and what to include, or he actually designs whole cities off on a hill where nothing exists in terms of urbanization. We have to look at our changes, and I think the strategic plans and local health departments are the way to look at it. We have to look at the whole picture and then develop ways in which to proceed, both on the social determinants and on the individual access.
Why don't we take, Amos had his hand up for quite a while. Go ahead.
What's the status of the Diamante driver bill? Is it likely that it will be passed in the next session of Congress? And if the answer is yes, how can that bill be amended so that there is some burden put on the primary care medical providers to do immediately some primary caries prevention amongst the children and also the elderly? Because the bill right now is silent on that.
In that direction.
It's all about dental care, and even if it got passed, a lot of the dental issues will be a long time a coming.
Right.
The medical piece can be put in place rather quickly.
Right. Alice, if you want to say
You want to repeat the question?
Amos asked about the status of the Diamante driver bill that I mentioned, Diamante's law, and whether what could be done to, if it isn't passed immediately, to enhance the primary care capacity for taking care of preventive needs for children, for young children.
There's no burden put on physicians to do anything that they can't, and they should, but the bill is silent on that.
I agree with you, but if we look at almost all legislation, look at the state of Maryland, where the problem has really arisen, and the entire bill and all of the money that the governor has given to us is all directed to treatment, to dental care, and how to get access. There's not one word in there from this about primary prevention and what needs to be done. And I even wrote a letter to the governor, and it came back, you know, with a boilerplate response that pat, pat, go away. But this is a major problem. We have allowed policymakers to believe that the best way to have oral health is go see your dentist.
Yes.
So not true, you guys.
We
got to change
that. What's the oral
health
section be doing?
Well, a lot of work.
I'm not sure on the status of the bill, by the way, right now. I can check on it.
I'm not either, but I just want to make a political point, a policy point, and that is we need a balanced portfolio. You have legislators who want to see, again, it's being practical. There are things they want to see done while they're in office. So it's going to be hard right now to get them to do things which have the major benefits, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. It's even a bigger problem with physical environmental policy than with social policy, where the impacts are very far off. It took 60 or 70 years to get the infrastructure we have and to have the suburban sprawl that we have and all the problems of, you know, of cars, single use, because we don't have mass transit and all those. So it's not going to turn around on a dime. And the same thing, we have to change the perspective. The same problem with medical care. People view that the way you get healthy is go to your doctor. Ain't true, but we have to disabuse people. It takes a while. A Partnership for Prevention, which is a nonprofit that I chair in Washington, does a lot of congressional briefings and work with the Congressional Prevention Caucus on these kind of issues. But it's trying to get people to think differently about the same things. And it's what's wonderful is that there's a growing understanding that these underlying determinants have to be addressed. And foundations have put money into some of the tools, Robert Wood Johnson particularly, but others as well. I mean, one of the things that I've been working on for the past 7 years is health impact assessment, looking at intersectoral efforts so one can see what's the benefit of investing in mass transit in terms of health. What's the benefit of changing the urban landscape in terms of health, traffic calming, school walkability, et cetera, et cetera. And we need to do the same thing. We need to show how a better educational system would improve health so that these people aren't making decisions about just transportation or education. They understand that their health impact. Nutrition. Well, if they don't think they're having any impact on oral health, then they don't have to worry about those issues if they're making nutrition policy. I mean, you know, look at the decision that was made about biodiesel. Now, if there was ever a political decision that didn't, you know, that was for a particular part of the country and has great difficulty understanding the science behind it, that was it. And yet, so we need to make sure that people in the Commerce Committee, Interstate Commerce, and that they're thinking about health impacts. The agriculture bill, the transportation bill, APHA is making collectively a big push to try and get involved in the transportation bill, which funnels a lot of money to states and localities. It's done a lot to make highways bigger and longer, but it hasn't done as much for mass transit. It hasn't really focused on what's the impact of climate change. Can we, how can we reduce carbon emissions, et cetera, et cetera. Well, APHA is now, I'm on the advisory committee for that. We're trying to figure out, okay, what's the strategy? We have to think of long-term, but we also have to think about short-term. And if we don't start where people's thinking is today and try and move them along and understand that in some cases we're going to have to make compromises, we're not going to get anything.
I see a lot of hands, and we don't have that much time, so I'm going to have to cut it short. We'll take three more questions. Larry, short question.
Well, it's a comment. And
stand up, please.
It's a comment, the first thing that I think of is we tend to look at who else can do something for us to put oral health at the forefront. And the first question really that needs to be asked, I think, is what have we done to put oral health at the forefront? For example, Diamante Driver. So we have something happening in Maryland, but how many people have gone to their vital statistics department to find out how many Diamante drivers there might be in their own communities or in their own states? We know that there was one the same week in Mississippi, but nobody talks about that. All we talk about is Diamante Driver. Well, that's great. That's the icon now for what we're doing, but who knows what's happened in their states? Who knows how many people have died from oral health, from oral cancer in their communities or in their states? Who's looked that question up? And who's going to a meeting in their community or their state when there's been a discussion about health care and new programs, and nobody's talking dental and has spoken up and said, what about dental? And then if you quickly get put down, stick with it, stay with it, and make sure that dental comes up to the forefront. And so I think, there's an awful lot that we need to do in order to force the issue. If we get the community involved and those constituents involved, I think we can get some of the folks like the local health officers to follow suit and be involved.
Thank you. Question back here.
Yeah, actually, just to follow that up, and actually more for Dr. Fielding, I'm actually one of the few, I guess, non-dental folks here, but I am married to Dennis. I'm at Harris County Public Health down in Houston, Texas, and we have had a dental chief position that's been vacant for we had a retirement 2-3 years ago. We've done everything in the world to recruit. We bumped a salary around $100,000, $130,000 range. All this stuff we try to get the word out. We're doing all these incredible things. We've taken our strategic plan. We've put chronic diseases of oral health in that strategic plan. So this goes back to the comment that was just made about the advocacy internal within the oral health movement. We are having trouble finding that oral health professional. It's hard enough to find docs that go into public health, but to find Dennis, I go to my wife and I say, hey, why don't you think about this position? She says, oh my gosh, here's what I can make in private practice. And it's such a huge disparity. And so from the standpoint of another local health officer, it is so challenging to be able to make that push of strategy in the community for oral health when we're even having trouble finding that leader to be able to push that forward. So I just wanted to bring that up as a real concern on the local public health level, even when you have advocacy and really support for that.
You make a very good point. Unfortunately, most dentists in public health who work for local and state government are probably making 50-60% of their peers in private practice. And when they get more training in public health, their income level goes down. Versus if they specialize in clinical dentistry, their income goes up 2 or 3 times. And that's a major disparity in the oral health workforce.
Well, it's not just oral health, it's education, like about medical schools, dental schools, residency. My wife had almost no exposure to public dentistry. And so how am I able to articulate what the importance is of not looking at the dollar, but really looking at the care that you can provide for folks in the community? So.
Well, your wife's fortunate that she married you. I'm sure you're very convincing.
Hasn't worked yet.
It's a process. The I don't think there's any substitute for how we're raising our children with respect to values. One of the things that I think will be a positive fallout of the terrible effects that this recession is going to have on so many Americans is that I hope people will stop measuring the value of life in terms of their net worth. And I don't know that that'll happen. It's probably optimistic on my part, but I think there's at least a chance that that'll happen. And it really goes back to that. What kind of values do you have? I have two children. One is 20 and one is 18. The one who's 20 is very socially concerned, involved, active. The one who is 18 is a libertarian. And I can't tell you why. And thinks that I'm crazy for taking the job that I have because I work, 24/7 and I make less than I could. And I think what it takes, though, is it takes a commitment. It takes people who make a decision not just with their pocketbook, but with their heart and their conscience. And that can't be taught. That has to be learned. Has to be something that people get from the way they're brought up. And even then, it won't always stick. But my feeling is that you need to find those special people. You need to nurture them along the way. This is the same trouble we have in healthcare. I was asked by the alumni head for Harvard Medical School to talk to the Los Angeles cohort of Harvard Medical School graduates. And I told them, they said, talk about public health. So I talked about public health. Their eyes were wide open. Gee, I didn't know all this stuff was public health because we didn't have a huge amount of public health in our training. So I ended up by saying, so if you want to minimize your income, maximize your political stress, and double your hours, public health is the job for you. And I don't think you have to go quite to that extent for dentistry, but it's up to all of us, and particularly you in this room, to nurture, to socialize those people who are special people, who care about the public more than they do about their individual maximizing their income. And I hope a reflection of a better nation will be an easier recruitment.
Howard, did you want to make a comment or not? Yeah, is that it? Okay. Okay, go ahead. Thank you very, very much, Jonathan and Dushyanta. Excellent panel. We have continuing education forms in the back through the American Dental Association. It's very simple to fill out. You just put your name, address, phone number, and email. And what you are, i.e. hygienist, dentist, whatever, and just leave it in the back of the room. We also have our evaluation forms for this session as part of continuing education. Very simple to fill out, takes 30 seconds. You can't leave the room till you fill these both out. And then the last thing I want to mention is our next session is at 2:30 in about 15 to 20 minutes. And it will be on oral health disparities, determinants and solutions, findings of the NIDCR Oral Health Disparity Centers. Thank you all very much.